Intertextual Cardboard Experience.
Hello and welcome to Intertextual Cardboard Experience. Today we have an interestingly intertextual 23rd guest, Justin Jacobson. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So sometimes in the intro, I missed it, but you are a game designer and you are the president and owner of Restoration Games.
That's correct. With my partner, Rob Davio, who's the real game designer, but I like to pitch in. It's fun. So yeah.
Yeah. Very, very cool. Yeah. Kind of, we'll get into it in the introductory questions, but eventually, I'm curious to kind of see what led you to that pairing with Rob. But before we get there, I just kind of want to think about your gaming background a little bit. Potentially, you know, with Restoration Games being a company that does, you know, look back and try to grab games from the past and, you know, restore them, remake them, change or, you know, re-release them in any different kind of types of way. Like perhaps some of the games you were playing are things that you have worked on, but on the whole, I'm just kind of curious about your entire gaming background. And then when did your interest and passion become a profession?
Sure. Well, I was a gamer even from like the various earliest age. And when I say that, I mean that even in sort of today's sense. I know a lot of people like, oh, we played games, but it was, you know, the mainstream games like Monopoly and Risk. And I played those as well. But my family, specifically my dad and my uncle, were actual gamers back then. They were into wargaming. My uncle in particular was big into the Euro games. He used to get them shipped over from Europe, you know. We were playing the very earliest editions of Dungeons and Dragons and things like that. So I was a real, real is not the right word. I'm not trying to gatekeep here or anything, but we were knee deep in all the geekiest forms of gaming, even from the earliest get-go, playing all sorts of what would be hobby games back then, even from when I was a kid. I had a game closet. It was huge and it was stuffed full of games, and not just, you know, the mainstream games, but a lot of these sort of esoteric games. So I've always been a gamer my entire life. And then also a lot of, like I mentioned, Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing games, played a lot of that as well. I think that sort of helped me on my way in terms of being a game designer. And then I did some self-publishing back during the Dungeons and Dragons third edition open gaming license, things like that. So I have sort of had dipped my toe in and always been interested in this sort of thing. But it was never on my radar to make it my profession until, you know, later on. So.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think like you kind of mentioned, there are definitely people that have, you know, a more typical quote unquote trajectory with you know, hobby games as opposed to the more mass market ones, and you know gamers are gamers, of course, and however you get into it is fantastic. But I hope that my current game closet will serve as an inspiration to any like future children or family or anything like that too. But that's awesome. So in terms of kind of like then some of the later on, professionally, I have zero expertise in law, but you like were or are a practicing lawyer?
both, and just in different ways, right? So, yeah, I'm a lawyer. I'm still licensed. But that's what I was going to do. And it's interesting. I went to college. I graduated high school in 1988, went to college, graduated college in 92. And then pretty much everyone who was graduating then who didn't really know what they wanted to do either went to law school or became a consultant. All my friends who became consultants, this was during the tech boom. They're all retired millionaires. All my lawyer friends are miserable. including me. I was pretty miserable after a little while. But basically, I went to law school. My dad was a lawyer as well. So it was always sort of in the back, you know, background is like, you know, my dad did it. He made a nice living. You know, it seemed fine, that sort of thing. It's what I knew. So yeah, I went to law school. And I was a practicing lawyer. I graduated law school in 95, worked a couple of years. My dad always said he wanted me to get disillusioned by the practice of law and underneath somebody else. So I went to another law firm, practiced a couple of years, hated it, went to work with him at his law firm, which was better, a much better situation. I didn't like the law that I was practicing when I got out of law school. It's medical malpractice defense, which was not my favorite. I did a lot of litigation for my dad. So I was in 97, or I think I came over, and was there for, you know, 20 years practicing law. The practice of law has just changed so much over the years, from even just from when I got out of law school until, you know, around 90, 2006 or so, in 2016. It changed quite a bit, especially the area of law that I was practicing in. I was doing commercial litigation, debt collection, things like that. That whole landscape just completely changed for the worse, in mine and probably most people's opinion. And it just, my dad had ended up retiring a few years before that. I had taken over the practice. A lot of the changes in that area of the law made the running the practice more challenging, and I was just really getting completely burnt out. And I sort of needed to make a change. I had always been interested in games, like I said. Well, here's the story. I've told this story a few times, but this is the story. This was, you know, 2010 and on or so. I forget when I started. I would go to Gen Con every year, and I would put on a legal Q&A seminar and just say, come ask me your legal questions. You know, I'll answer anything you want. And that was how I wrote off the trip as a business expense. I had taken clients from there. I had met people in the game industry, and I had represented them in very sort of minimal ways, you know, drafting contracts for them and things like that. Again, during that time, I was self-publishing in Dungeons and Dragons, on third edition. So I would help a lot of people out, particularly in the RPG side of things. Again, you know, drafting simple contracts for artists and things like that. I was sort of my pro bono to the industry, because not a lot of folks in the industry can afford their own lawyer. And I did this Q&A, and I went and answered a lot of questions. And one time, after one of those seminars, a woman came up to me and said, "Hey, my husband is getting ready to leave Hasbro. Can we take you to dinner? We've got a few questions." That was Lindsay Davio, Rob's wife. And we went to dinner, and he had just finished releasing. They had released Risk Legacy. He was going out on his own. He had some questions about sort of what he could do with the whole legacy thing. Was working on Seafall at the time. This was before he even got started on Pandemic Legacy with Matt Leacock. And I just, you know, gave him some advice. And then after that time, I essentially was Rob's lawyer, again, reviewing his contracts with other publishers and things like that. And so we just were periodically in touch about things like that. And Rob and I are a month apart in age, very similar interests, all that stuff. So, and then one day, like I said, I just was completely burnt out. I went to lunch with a couple of my friends, both of whom became consultants in the tech bubble, and were one was retired, one was still noodling around in the tech area, but they were both doing quite well. I mentioned how burnt out I was, and they said, "Listen, I had told them this idea I had. This was right when Kickstarter was taken off. I was like, I want to republish an old game. I wanted to do, at the time, my idea was to do Queen's Gambit, Star Wars Queen's Gambit, take out the Star Wars license and redo it somehow." And I was like, "With Kickstarter now, you could do that. Like, you didn't have to have, you know, being a game publisher was board game publisher was a lot easier along the lines of what I had done with the third edition Dungeons and Dragons. Like, you could publish a game now because of Kickstarter." And I had this idea, and they basically just gave me the push I needed and said, "Listen, you should do it." My wife, incredibly supportive. Pretty much anyone who knew me saw that I couldn't keep going like I was going. And they just all gave me that little push to do it. I made offer Rob, made Rob an offer he couldn't refuse. I basically said, "I'll handle all the business nonsense. Just help me make the games." And he was like, sure. I think you like the idea. We talked about at that time what other games, what games could we actually do and that sort of thing. And that's how we started. And we started the company in 2016, first published game in 2017. And at Gen Con was our first real release, Downforce, Stop Thief, and Indulgence. And I'll never forget. We went to that Gen Con in 2017, had a teeny tiny little 8x10 booth in the back corner of the exhibit hall. And opening day, Downforce had gotten some good reviews, so had the other games also. And we had a line around the corner. And I was like, it hit me that that was it. Like it was going to work. And that was when I could officially, transition. To go back to the very original question, I'm still a lawyer. I'm still licensed, and I still do a lot of law stuff. It's just all related to Restoration Games now, right? So I still handle all the contracts and the licensing, and if any of the issues come up, I do still do all the not all the business stuff. So we have a huge crew now. We started with just Rob, myself, and Jason Taylor, and Lindsay Davio came over pretty quickly for the graphic side of things, and now we're up to 13 people, I think. So we have a lot of other people to help with some of the business stuff. So now I don't have to do quite as much of that as I originally promised Rob either. But here we are.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, so yeah, knocked out kind of a lot of thoughts and questions that I
Yeah.
had. No, that's perfect. And so just kind of thinking about maybe a little bit, then versus now too, things have changed with your role within the company a little bit, but not a ton, just maybe, the more people, more stuff, I guess, overall. Enough to not try to oversimplify it too much, but I guess working with okay, if I'll ask another question before asking this one. So if you were going
Okay.
to kind of just describe the overall vision of Restoration Games, and perhaps even in about the 8 years, what has changed and what you're like continually trying to like push to do like within the space, because I think what the work that you're doing is definitely different and unique, and I think that's why you are seeing the success that like from the get-go people are like, oh, this is an interesting idea. But if you could kind of explain that before I ask this next question, I think that'd be neat.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest transition that we've made is that we've become much more of like a splashy release company. When we started, we did these three games. We did a couple of other, smaller games, Dinosaur Tea Party and Conspiracy and those sorts of things. And that was something we always thought, hey, we should release some other games. And these were games that were maybe based on older games that people either very few people knew about or were more obscure, but that we thought there was something really cool about that game that we could sort of reintroduce it. And then we did the Fireball Island Kickstarter, which was a massive success for us. And you could see, and then over time, it sort of transitioned like that's sort of what people really want, those sort of blockbuster games, if you will. And there are, Dark Tower and Thunder Road, and we have some other upcoming stuff, Crossbows and Catapults, things like that. And so, we still have some interest in some of these other games, but a lot of our bandwidth is focused on making sure we're looking at some of these sort of, blockbuster games that we can do that other people aren't able to do. Like, there's lots of great publishers out there, and yeah, it's Downforce is a great game. But there are lots of great games out there, and so it's hard to stand out. And our brand has really come to be about those bigger names, the splashier titles, the more toyetic stuff, bigger productions, things like that. That's what a lot of our fans are looking forward to, like with good game underneath all that too, obviously. So yeah, I think that's sort of been the biggest change. Recently, we started getting into doing some licensing. Obviously, with Unmatched has been a big success for us as well. And part of that is this sort of combination of both unlicensed sets, but also the different licenses as well. And so we're continuing to do a lot of that, which was not something we ever did when we started either.
Nice. Yeah, so I guess just that sounds awesome. And I think, a lot of the things that you said there are things that I'm thinking about and I'll actually probably kind of like repackage and ask some questions about in a little bit. But, with the overall process of, working with different licensing or, taking older games, I don't want this question to sound stupid, but, how difficult overall is that process, and or do you feel like there are any, or I mean, what are some sort of instances where you've run into like more roadblocks than you necessarily expected?
Sure, it's not a stupid question at all. In fact, it's probably the most challenging part of our job, and certainly interesting part of my job personally, principally because there's two reasons. First of all, no game is always the same, right? Like each game has its own quirks about this current situation and how we might go about doing a restoration. But also importantly, from when we started the company, it was always important to us, there are legal requirements, things legally we have to figure out, how to navigate those issues. But then there are also ethical issues that we always, from the get-go of the company, decided that we were going to abide by. So there's a lot of gray area in terms of some intellectual property law regarding, old published games that are out of print. But one of the things we always said when we started is that we were going to go back to the original designers of the game and work with them in some capacity, whatever that might end up being, based on, what we were doing. Even if we didn't have a legal obligation to do so, we always felt that that was sort of the right thing to do. So we have had games, Conspiracy is a perfect example. That game was long out of print. I'm not sure we needed to do anything, but we approached, Dr. Solomon at the time and offered him a royalty, or we, oftentimes we'll phrase it as an honorarium. Sometimes if it's not a royalty, strictly doesn't make sense. We had another game, Indulgence was an interesting one because that designer had passed away. And we had tried to get in contact with, some of his heirs, and we couldn't reach anybody. And so we made the game. And then someone reached out to us afterwards and contacted us, and we ended up paying compensation on that. Again, even if legally we, and I think it's safe to say legally, we weren't required to, but it was the right thing to do. So again, that does make it challenging. Something like Return to Dark Tower, obviously, has its own very storied legal past. There was litigation over the original publication of that game, which made it a bit of a challenge. And so yes, it's always very interesting. Some are more interesting and more challenging than others, but and some of that can factor into whether or not we continue to pursue a game. We've had games. We had a game that we were looking at. I won't mention it because I don't want to mention the designer, but the designer was, maybe to put it away, very precious about their original design and just wasn't super open to this idea. Again, we probably could have just gone ahead with it, but there's plenty of other candidates out there. We decided not to, and we just never ended up making that game. So it's always an interesting process. And then part of it is why, it's a lot more interesting than, litigating credit card claims.
Oh
That's why
yeah.
I'm happier now, even when I'm doing the law stuff.
Yeah, that's really neat. I mean, I think just kind of that overall process too that you mentioned of, reaching out and doing these things that, legally probably unnecessary or unnecessary, but just I think the way in which you're doing it will make sense. But furthermore, I think just kind of shows, like you said, there are options out there. You want to pursue what makes the most sense, and you want to pursue ultimately what's going to feel like, like the best finished product. And if that has like the former designer's stamp of approval or whatever, like I just think that adds to the overall story of how that game was, restored ultimately.
Yeah, it is. It's all part of the process that makes it fun and interesting from like just bringing in a fresh design and doing a new game. Like, there's something to be said for that, but I think our story is definitely a little different, which in some ways helps us stand out from the crowd, right? I mean,
That's neat. So, kind of a start of a two-part question then. So you mentioned that you do reach out to, the original designers and will include like royalties or the honorary bit. Is there any kind of part of that process or any of the games where you explicitly seek input from original designers regarding the redesign, or are they mostly kind of out of the picture outside of like, hey, that is cool. I want this game to be get like a new audience.
We haven't run into that yet. I think a lot of that's because our the designs that we're looking at are pretty old. We don't generally look at anything less than 20 years old. So a lot of those designers are not moving on, have moved on. They're not still active. I guess one of the big exceptions to that was Downforce with Wolfgang Prommer, who's a legendary designer and still cranking out amazing titles, but he's also just sort of busy on his own designs and respect. Part of it, I'm sure, is also that Rob Daviau is on the team. He's also a legendary game designer. So, Wolfgang's like, yeah, I'm sure Rob will come up with something good for it, right? Like, so that certainly helps a lot. We haven't really had that. It's interesting. The closest we've gotten to that is when we did Crossbows and Catapults. Stephen Baker, who did some work on Weapons and Warriors, which was a sort of an analog on that, so he was at least in that working in that sort of game style, is on our team. He does the operations and business stuff for us, but he's also a legendary game designer, and he did a lot of the work on that as well. But he's also part of our team, so it's a little different now, right? But yeah.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah, I was just curious if it was, yeah, like you said, if with that distance, like that 20 plus years or whatever it might be, that probably just makes most people who contact be like, yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah.
Like, go for it. Like, I'm done
Pretty
with it.
much, yeah.
Okay, cool. And then, just kind of, going off of that question a little bit, I've definitely talked to a lot of designers that either will exclusively work in like a co-design space, or will do into like solo independent design, and then we'll kind of mix between that and co-design as well. But it seems like a lot of your games have like a pretty strong team aspect behind them. And if you just look, I mean, this is just me looking
Yeah.
at design credits for a lot of the games and all of that. And I know that that takes shape in all sorts of different ways. So I guess more of a kind of the modern the 2024 restoration process, especially with a lot of these bigger projects like the Return to Dark Tower, the Thunder Road Vendetta and all that. Like, how would you describe the kind of current design process or the designers who's working on what things of that nature?
Sure. Yeah. We very much are a team design approach. So first of all, whenever we list the game credits, we always list the original designers. That's another part of that aspect. So they're always in there. And then most of the games that we've worked on, we've designed in-house, where we have a design team that's principally now myself, Rob, and Noah Cohen is our other main designer. You also see Brian Neff's name on a lot of stuff. He was part of the design team for quite a while, but he's taken on more of a project management role now. And then occasionally, so that's the majority of it. So most of the designs are that. For some of the games, we've had some other people pitch in here or there, whether it's particular modes of play or something like that. We've had some outside developers. Thunder Road Vendetta is a little bit different. That was one that was originally designed by Jim Kiefer. Who's listed there? But then the original redesign or restoration, if you will, was Brett Myers and Dave Chalker, because they were huge Thunder Road fans and they had been working on their own sort of redesign of Thunder Road for a long time, which I knew about, and often told them like, "Hey, we've been trying to work on that one for a while. We haven't been able to get the rights to it or anything like that." And then finally we did, and so I went to them and said, "Hey, if you guys want to do the initial development work on that." But then ultimately, again, we have a Rob Davio in-house, so we're not going to not use that resource. So whenever that design gets turned over to us, there's always some level of development at the end that we're going to be doing. For a lot of the game, Unmatched was fully designed in-house. But again, if you look on some of the design credits there, there might be a person outside who designed a deck or two in the set, and they'll be listed there. But invariably, there's going to be some final last mile of design that's going to be done by the in-house team, which is, again, Rob, myself, and Noah. So.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, so I don't know if what I'm about to say is going to be more of a question or a statement, but I actually just okay, first time I most of my restoration experience is through Unmatched. I own Conspiracy, the Solomon Gambit, which is neat that you took the original designer's name and incorporate that into the title as well, which is fun. And I am now awaiting the most recent Kickstarter of Thunder Road Vendetta as well.
Nice.
But well, a lot of it is just me being behind on my games, which I am. So I finally recently just, punched and played Unmatched Adventures Tales to a Maze, and then punched and opened and played that with the Slings and Arrows set of Unmatched, which for me was fun because I am pretty big into Shakespeare. I can't claim any type of expertise, but I've read enough of enough Shakespearean plays in my life, probably more than most people, let's put it that way. And so that was a fun little Mothman versus a Shakespeare
Sure. As soon as you tell
clash.
people that, that's the explanation for Unmatched in a nutshell, right? Shakespeare versus Mothman.
But you mentioned some of the kind of the ways and the overall vision way things have shifted, and having like the cinematic experiences, and Unmatched has that mix and match capability to kind of grow it and make it bigger. But I think just overall, one of the things that I notice, going the whole production to me when I open up something that's created by Restoration Games is an experience. So, I know always have absolutely fantastic artists. The rule books are laid out, in my opinion, like excellently. You just mentioned, the only reason this was kind of triggered in my head was that certain people will design different decks, but you look at the rule book and it's like very clearly on the back of this set, it's like showing who was working on what decks. And I obviously most games are giving proper attribution, but I think the overall presentation and production of the games and the way that it shows who's working on what highlights the team element of it, and then also even in something like Unmatched, kind of that fun, modularity as well. But
I appreciate that. It's a good time for me to mention, we call them the picture people. So I mentioned Jason Taylor, Lindsay Davio, also Ian Reed is on the team now. We have our marketing people, Suzanne Sheldon, Brian Neff, project manager, Jen Skayen, and Josh Heek, our customer service and logistics people, and then Josh Willenbrinks, our operations logistics person. I'm so proud of the team that we've created. Like Rob and I have always been very careful about who we brought on, and we've never had anyone leave the company. We've been around for 6 years. We've added several people. We've never had anyone leave. We've always prided ourselves, Rob and I, first and foremost, like putting out good work, being a good atmosphere, a good group. Like our culture for our company is something we've been very strong on trying to preserve. Our branding, the same thing. We feel like we've got a very strong brand. That's not by accident either. It's the same thing.
Yeah, sorry. I'm gonna close up my window. I wanted some fresh air, but there's some yard work. I'll be 2 seconds.
Okay.
I was foolishly hopeful that having my window open would just bring in fresh air, but it more so brought in a ton of yard work sounds, so just kind of cutting the interim, and we're back to it.
Perfect. We'll stay on Unmatched for a second. I think I mentioned to you in the pre-show talk that I have a lot of different thoughts and they're all over the place, but I think this is kind of like a good thought for that. But you talked about working and just like your initial partnership with Rob Davio, but Unmatched is the re-implementation of Star Wars Epic Duels. So I am not particularly familiar with it. I've gone on the Board Game Geek page, saw like some pictures. I know that the note in the Unmatched rulebook mentions how the tactical map, it also uses like the Tannhauser system for range, which I think is like a very smart and good approach for it. But I think kind of for you, like early on, what were some of the things that were worked into the game as like similarities? And then what were some initial changes, and then how, I mean, obviously the system's just taken off, so I think difference is now just might be the fact that Unmatch is huge, but kind of like early on, like what were some of the things that you and Rob were working to keep the same from Star Wars Epic Duel to Unmatched, and then just some of the early kind of tweaks.
Yeah, it's funny. So I used to always, I still listen to the Dice Tower quite a bit. And one of the old, founders on there, contributors, longtime contributors, was Sam Healy, who often mentioned the Tannhauser range, system and like how good it was, and somebody should bring it back. So I just sort of had that in my subconscious. And then when we were looking at Unmatched, we really one of the couple there were two like main things that sort of, about Star Wars Epic Duels that like, didn't hold up, that we didn't think held up really well. One was rolling for movement, obviously is a big issue because, that can really affect gameplay. If you're rolling ones and your opponent's rolling sixes, you're just going to have a bad time of it. It's just a lot of randomness for that, for what's a sort of key part of the game. And so we took that out. We put a standard move for each of the fighters. But then also you can boost it by discarding a card so that it gives you some flexibility, but it at a cost. So there's some decision making there, et cetera, et cetera. And then the other thing was, again, this range system. So in Star Wars Epic Duels, it was they had a very simple line of sight, which was basically like if in the straight line, you could see them. But what's interesting is you'd be in a wide open space, but if you like move one space to the left, all of a sudden they can't see you anymore, which is kind of weird. It's fine for a game, I suppose, but it's not super realistic. And so the Tannhauser range system was like, hey, why don't we just try this out? And it worked really well. I guess one of the couple of the big changes, obviously, like we were figuring out, in the early design, some of the numbers on the cards were really weird. I remember we had a character that had like a, 28 health, which we've now done with the T-Rex, but in a whole different way. We had someone with like a defense 13, things like that. So we finally figured out the numbers, that kind of stuff. And actually, one of the biggest changes was the map design, getting the movement. The original maps were much bigger and too big. So it was like too much running around and not enough, of the fighting and things like that. So getting that balance all right. And then, we've learned a lot over time. The first set still holds up really well, but there's obviously things that we've learned then about how to better balance, some of these fighters. We have a whole competitive scene now, which is amazing. Literally hundreds of people in these, biannual major tournaments, not to mention all the little tournaments they run. And they give us a lot of great feedback, and we can see some of what high-level play is. Also, keeping in mind, of course, most of the people playing these games are not competitive players, but they do have some good insights that we try and incorporate now. So we've just gotten a little more experienced and more sophisticated about how to design those games and what makes for interesting characters and what effects work and what don't and that sort of thing. How to write the cards better. Sherlock Holmes is a cool character and he does some really weird stuff, but he's also got a lot of wonky interactions with, a lot of rules clarifications we needed to make with him, that kind of stuff. So we're constantly learning, but I feel like we've gotten pretty good at it now as it's, developed into a mature line. So
Yeah. Okay. I have a few follow-up questions for that.
sure.
So, I can't say that I've ever been a part of any competitive scene for any board or card game. The most competitive stuff that I've ever done has kind of been in the, like digital CCG space, if anything, and not even particularly serious there. So, with you mentioned kind of some of the earlier, thoughts or balance. Balances, and this is just me not knowing much at all. Like I did know that there was a competitive unmatched scene, but in that space, are there like banned matchups or characters, or what's kind of like the that with the
Yeah, so there's like a little committee who sort of set up the rules for the tournaments. They've done some different tournament formats. They don't generally ban anyone in terms of like a general ban, but they do have the system that they implement is a lot of like where in each individual match, there's like where you're picking your fighters and you're banning other fighters and things like that. So it does sort out to where there's definitely some higher tier characters. Elektra is sort of notorious. I think Doctor Strange is up there. Maybe a couple others. I can't remember off the top of my head, but like that they'll essentially always get banned because they're just sort of too good. And then of course there's some fighters who are just not good enough. They're not going to get picked very frequently. Like once or twice during a tournament, someone might end up with one of them somehow. Same with the maps. So it's one of the things we've learned along the way is we used to think the maps were sort of pretty fungible. But then we learned over time that the node layouts for the spaces can actually make some interesting impact on play more than what you might think just by a couple of little connections here and there. And so the competitive players obviously know a lot about that. And so picking a map that's more suited to the character that you've ended up you're playing with. There's a lot of matchup issues, like some fighters are very good into other fighters, so there's some strategy there. So it's super interesting. I enjoy watching it, the tournaments when they happen. A lot of those matches are streamed, which is fun. So it's really taken off. It's great to see. It's very rewarding for us to see that kind of thing happen. And they're enjoying it. So that's also great, right? Like people having fun with their game. That's the point.
Yeah, no, I think that's really neat. I can't ever see myself getting to that point. A, 'cause
So
I don't think I'm particularly good.
it's funny. They keep asking like us to play and like, oh, they want me to play in one of the tournaments. I'm like, you guys would crush me. I don't, for starters, I rarely play the fighters after they're published. Like we're working on the sets that are happening, in 2025. So by the time they get published, I've forgotten how they even work usually. So
Yeah, no, I just like, I mean, I think it is an interesting game in that people can interact with it in so many different ways. I mean, there's so much, content. There's so many characters and maps and sets and like everything that a tournament scene makes sense. I know that there are the people that will just say, "Hey, I like, busting open a new character and trying them out." I think I'm probably a little bit more in the middle ground where I want to like at least see a co character a couple times or a few times before like moving on, just like not become good with them necessarily, but just to see the ways in which I like messed up in game one and game two inevitably before moving on. But I think like for me, and even though it is relatively smaller, especially when it's set up, I would say my collection of it is not small by any stretch of the imagination. But you mentioned like the shift to and I think this is something to get to in just a bit, but like in those I've mentioned it before, those bigger games, that there is that cinematic experience. But to me, I like all the character that all of these different characters bring, just like the minimal flavor text, the fantastic art and graphic design. I just think it, and the fact that it is a tactical movement game and that these characters have their special powers that make sense for them. To me, it's just, I think the things that stick out to me most are just like moments from the game that feel like cinematic or silly, or the first time playing the second set. So not volume two with,
You're
oh
talking about
shoot.
Babylon's Line 2 or Goblin Fog?
Not Cobble and Fog. Cobble and Fog had some great moments when I first busted that one out, but Volume Two, like the map started
Bloody
into,
Mary and Achilles. Oh, the map,
the high ground.
Hanging Gardens with the high ground. Yeah.
Yeah, there was just some like really funny moments. Like the first person who I played that against were just kind of like dancing around the high ground and just,
Everyone busts out the quote from episode 3 too, you know. I have the
yeah.
high ground now.
Hey, that's a complete like recircling to the Star Wars epic duels nature of it, right? But no,
I agree. I think the because there's so many interesting characters, and because we were so committed from the beginning that each deck should really, we could do whatever we want within that deck that would just make it emulate that character, that they really feel like the character you're playing, like committing to that fully, is what makes for those interesting moments. Because then you get the weird matchups, right? Like Bruce Lee versus the Raptors, or Shakespeare versus the Mothman. And you have Shakespeare completing some line and defeating Mothman, and you get to read out the line, and no, I agree. I think that's what makes it special. We got lucky with a little bit of the secret sauce, how everything came together. I always say the game design is a little bit like alchemy, right? Like a lot of times it's more than the sum of its parts. And I really feel like Unmatched is a great example of that.
Yeah. Funnily, so I was playing with Shakespeare, and it was just me, because I hadn't played the Adventures Tale to Amaze, and I just wanted to because it was about time. And then I went I so I read the special power of the syllables to complete the lines on the card, and then I opened up the character specific rule set, and it said, "Hey, read it aloud." And I was just by myself. I'm like, "Oh, I guess I'm reading this aloud right now."
Well, when you're alone, you can ham it up even more,
I
right?
know. Get to
Yeah.
practice. See if my acting career can resurrect itself by playing a little bit of Shakespeare. But interestingly, too, I know that in, well, Shakespeare in general and in Romeo and Juliet, there's that monologue from Romeo earlier where he says banished, but he says it banished, so with like
Right.
the accent over the E. And I know that that's like emphasizing how bad he thinks the banishment is. And then I knew that the prince at the end of the play, which is where the all are punished card line comes from, that he in towards the end also says like punished too, but I had to look it up. I was like, oh, he didn't keep it consistent because it is all are punished. There is no extra syllable, but hey, it made me do my studying as well.
Yeah, I mean, so sometimes we will make, exceptions here and there, like for simplicity. Obviously we need to keep the syllables all even. That was important. And then my so it's funny, there's like a running joke on the team, but I'm the one who's like really into the card names. And so I was like, hey, if it's a good card name, we'll keep it in, even if we have to, tweak the pronunciation a little bit, that kind of thing. So
Oh, yeah, but in this case, you didn't even. It was right.
right.
I was wrong. I had to look back. Yep,
Some people have mentioned that though,
Well, yeah, I just knew that at one point he did say punished, but he didn't in that line. He said it in the next
yeah. Oh,
like little
okay.
chunk line. So you're all clear. I
All right, great.
that's like Folger's Shakespeare edition, double checking you. But no, I was double checking myself, and it was good. It's good to know.
Okay,
I
great.
didn't think the card was wrong. I had to fix my brain's orientation to make sure that I could see the line correctly in my head more than anything. So, a couple more questions. So, you did mention in the process or the way that things have changed in the kind of development of Unmatch and how you feel like a lot of things have kind of smoothed out with it. I guess as you go on then, do you feel as if kind of like the balancing of characters, you have like such a good grip on the system where that's become easier, or does it become a little bit more daunting thinking about the character in the entire sphere of all these other characters?
In general, it's gotten a lot easier. A couple reasons. First of all, we don't generally worry about how a character is going to do outside of the box in which they're delivered, right? We're very committed to making sure we call it in-box balance is spot on. So that if you buy the box, if that's your first box or your only box, you're going to get it. Everything's going to be fun. We didn't quite nail that with Battle of Legends Volume 1. At the time. But again, having now know a lot more about the system and how to design those characters, we're much better at it. And the other thing is we've again got our playtesting has ramped up so much. We have because the game's gotten so popular, we have a large playtesting pool. We actually have a small focus group of competitive players that we sometimes send the characters over to try and break them or find weird interactions that sort of regular playtesters might not see. That sort of thing. So we're doing a lot more extensive playtesting. We're playtesting in a couple of different ways, so that I think we're able to manage that. And we've just gotten more knowledgeable about the design the more we've designed in the system, so that we have a better idea of things that work or things that don't work that might cause problems, that sort of thing. Things like card recursion or healing for certain characters and things like that.
Yeah, very, very cool. Yeah, I noticed too. I mean, in my game, the skunk ape killed me sooner than I could get through all the cards in my deck, which I guess I should have seen some coming how badly I was playing. But I kind of flipped through all the cards and noticed that Shakespeare didn't have any of the scheme cards because of
Right.
the lines, which again makes a lot of sense. But it was just like a fun like touch to consider. But yeah, I don't know. I love that game. I think it's filled with so much overall character, and I don't know. I have more for it than I could like ever get tired of, and then I'm going to keep buying more and more sets as they come out. So you got a
Well,
life
thank you.
lifelong customer there.
I keep telling it, so we love making it, and people always ask, I was like, I'll keep making it as long as people keep buying it because we enjoy making it. And I always tell people, oh, they want to see a particular hero. I was like, the longer it keeps going, the more likely it is. So.
I'm glad you mentioned it before, but I'm glad that you take a lot of care and fun with the card names, because I get a kick out
That's good to hear. I'm going to take
of
that back to my team. They all
them.
mock me about it, but
No.
everybody likes the card names. The thing that's interesting is on the design team, we all sort of if we're when we're designing a new deck, we all sort of take different approaches to it. Some people think of a mechanic that would be suitable and then build the deck around the mechanic, or I think Rob thinks about like what he wants the play experience for that character to be like. And I literally start by writing out a list of card names. Like, what are the card names that has to be in this character's deck? Especially for the licensed sets, that's a lot of fun. I remember when we were working on Jurassic Park, I was like, all right, I'm sitting down and watching Jurassic Park with my, notepad and my pen, and every cool line gets written down. And like, that's a cool name for a card. And then I think, like, okay, that's the card name. What would that card with that name do? And that's how I sort of come up with the deck. So.
Oh, cool. So I guess my final question then would be favorite character, not necessarily favorite to play, but kind of thinking about maybe the process of watching Jurassic Park and coming up with the card names or the characters based on that. But what, I guess, to you, whether it is favorite to play with, most fun creating, or some potentially even sentimental attachment, who's number one or pretty close if you can't come up with that one?
Yeah, I mean, my number one's always been Bruce Lee. I'm a huge Bruce Lee fan. When we had the opportunity to work on that license, I was like, I'm doing this deck, folks. I don't know what to tell you. It's all me. And again, working on that deck. People, everyone helps out with the deck as far as the mechanic or whatever, giving ideas or whatever. But then, coming up with the card names and how he works, and it just, again, it feels when you can get a turn where you're, you flip out, you whip out the nunchaku, and then you reel off like four punches. It just is so fantastic. It's like my favorite. So yeah, definitely Bruce.
Perfect. Yeah, I fortunately I was gifted a box of Bruce before Bruce became like impossible to find,
Impossible
so
to find, yeah.
so
Unfortunate, yeah. So it is what it is.
it is what it is. But yeah, I like I said, I definitely it was a very kind gesture that I was given that gift, and it's I don't know, sitting right there, so I'm happy to have it. Okay. Cool. So I think in the previous talk about Unmatched, I mean, obviously, that game does a lot to draw. Well, first off, it, remade the Star Wars Epic Duel. It takes from all these different stories, whether they're intellectual properties, older lores and legends and things like that, and movies and I think, thinking about the show and like the kind of intertextual nature, I think that the game works really well in that space for me, which is part of the reason why I do like it so much. But you are also working on other games, and a couple of the bigger projects I've said them a couple times now are Return to Dark Tower and then Thunder Road Vendetta. And as you talked about a little bit of the shift in, thinking about these games as like, bigger, splashier projects that have like this kind of, either cinematic and or toyetic factor to them, but then also like having the game underneath to like keep the people there. So obviously, like that flash or that initial allure kind of goes so far, but I think I haven't played either of those and will definitely want to, definitely will for sure play both and get Thunder Road when I get that one. But I think that not just the production, but like a lot of the positive feedback about the games is that they kind of similarly do create these, kind of like big, fun, like raucous experiences. So kind of like within that scope of like revisiting, revising, restoring, and taking these like older games. I guess I'm not asking for you to like spill the magic necessarily, but I guess, what's kind of like the overall almost like marketing and game parallel, because it does have kind of like that movie feel, like people would be interested in Thunder Road Vendetta if they're into like the Mad Maxy like apocalyptic things. So like how in creating like these bigger kind of Kickstarter projects and taking an older game, I guess just that's not a good question, but what are some of your thoughts to all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is what's interesting thing about a lot of these games, when we're talking about games from like the 80s and 90s or whatever, is they had these something some cool hook. There's always some cool hook that we always say, like, what's the soul of that game? Why, what is the reason that people still remember that game 30, 40 years later? It's not because they really liked the roll and move mechanic, right? There's some other element to it, which we always have referred to as the soul of the game. And so when we're doing a restoration, we're always like, that we need to have that. And so one part of that is we will ask people, like when we say, oh, we're doing Thunder Road Vendetta, and people say, oh, I'm so excited. We'll say, why? What is it that you has to be in that restoration? What are you going to be upset if it's not there? The rotating board, or the choppers, or whatever it might be. And so we always make sure, we always say, we take that soul of that game. We want to turn that up to 11, in the words of Spinal Tap, right? And then we're building a modern game around it. And anything else that might be part of that older game, if we can find a place for it, great. But if not, if it's a choice between keeping some older piece or, finding a modern alternative to it that's going to improve the play or the player experience, we're going to go with that because we still got that core soul of the game that we're focusing on. And so that is a key part of that restoration process. That I think is what has given us our success. We've learned again, we've been around for a while, we've done more projects, we've gotten better about that process. And it's why some people, anyone can do a reprint and just, use better art or use better, components than the game from 30 years ago. But finding out that, again, the alchemy of like which parts to tweak and which need to, stay pretty much the same is something that we've developed over time. And I think is an important part of it for sure.
Yeah, that's really like kind of interesting. So yeah, because I mean I wasn't gaming in the 80s. I wasn't around in the 80s, but I growing up still played a fair share of the role to move. So yeah, I mean like some of those changes are going to be kind of obvious. It's like, well, we're not going to include that because nobody wants to play like a game that makes you feel that particular way, but they still want to play that game because of, like you said, that's all.
And we get people when we do a restoration, Thunder Road or Dark Tower, whatever it is, they're like, oh, I like the original better. I didn't like the changes you made. There's always going to be people like that. And that's what makes horse races, right? But we have to stay committed to sort of our vision about what's going to make a great modern game of that game. It's still going to be that game, but it's going to be a modern version of it. There are some people who just want reprints and with, better components and better art. And that's just not what we do, right? So.
Yeah, and for those people, well, those reprints do exist in different spaces, so
Sure.
they can go find
Yep.
them. That's awesome. Yeah, so I think through a lot of like the conversation, a lot of the things that you've been touching on have made me think about like the process of what Restoration Games is doing differently, because, well, obviously, I can see it from, the consumer or player side a bit. But yeah, thinking about like that process as a company that is definitely doing something that's different. I one of the reasons I reached out to, and I even mentioned a couple of the things to potentially talk about, is the fact that, like remakes or remasters or restorations, or taking a series in from the 80s and renewing it for like 2020s, like that happens in movies and televisions and all sorts of other things. But having it exist in the board game space is definitely unique. And as you kind of outlined, a lot of like the challenges and also just like the fun challenges of being able to go about that and like work with your team and then develop things and these systems that you can, grow and learn from seems like very, very special. But I guess my final question before getting to our wrap up thoughts then is thinking about this idea of like remasters or remakes in other mediums before getting to the final two questions. So I guess question A of two, A and B here, is what are some of your kind of like favorite remakes or remasters or redos, whatever you want to call them, in a different medium? So like a video
Sure.
game, a show, whatever.
Sure. I've got two that just came immediately to mind. That must be good examples, right? So in movies for me, it's very easy. I'm a huge Mission Impossible fan. I like the original show, and I love the new movies. They're very different, right? It's a sort of a good example. It's funny. My dad, who was a huge fan of the original show, does not like the movies because they're not like the show. They're sort of modern reinterpretations of that general theme. They have some of these key elements like the misdirection, the faces, and that sort of stuff that's there, but it's in the context of a modern movie. And so I really dig that. And he didn't, right? He was the one who said, no, I just want them to remake the old show, so that one for me is an easy one. And then it's funny, the other one I just thought of, I don't know why it came to my mind, but I was a big fan of Goldfinger, the band back in the day. This was again 1980s band, and they did a remastered version of some of their big hits fairly recently that I just stumbled on, and they're much cleaner. A lot of them have like a guest vocalist on them or whatever. And so they're very different. Like they're not as punk. They don't have that punk aesthetic quite as much, but I really dig them. Like I don't know why. And I like both of them. But they're definitely different. But I really liked how they had, again, it felt to me like what we do with games is sort of what they had done with their music there. So that again immediately came to mind because I just found the remasters that they had done just a few months ago, I think. So those are my two examples.
Those are good examples. And I don't know if this is embarrassing to admit on air. I'm not I just haven't watched many of the Mission Impossible movies, if any, outside of maybe bits and pieces on TV, but I didn't know that it was an action series.
Yeah.
Well, that gives me something to, look into a little bit. That's interesting. That's fun. So then, the question B then is, what is a remake in some capacity for any medium that you would like to see?
Oh, that's a good question. Not sure. That's an interesting one. Actually, oh, I just thought of this the other day. I've got one. This is really obscure. There is an old TV show from the 80s called Stingray, and it was about a guy who was very mysterious guy. And he basically had an ad in the paper that was sort of about you trading for his, he'll trade you his car. He has a Stingray, a car. And, but it was really like secretly, like, if you need help, contact this number and I'll help you out, basically. Sort of like an equalizer type thing, And, but what it was is he never took payment for his services. If you called him, he would help you. And then as a result of him helping you owed him a favor. You owed him one favor, and at some point he will ask you for that favor. It might be easy, it might be hard, but you had to do it. And so, of course, each episode, not only is he helping somebody, but during the episode, he's calling on people who he has in the fictional world previously helped for to do these favors, and sometimes they're big favors, and sometimes they're not. But it was a really cool premise, some really neat show episodes. But it would be so good, such a good for a modern show. In the same way, since I mentioned, I might as well reiterate that I also think the Equalizer remakes, the movies with Denzel Washington. I haven't actually seen the new show with Queen Latifah, but I used to watch the old TV show in the 80s, was great. And I also like the new movies. And same, very similar to the Mission Impossible shift. There's a bit more action and violence into the Equalizer movies, but I like both of those. But I would love to see like a Stingray restoration in the vein of the new Equalizer and Mission Impossible movies. I think that'd be really cool. He's a cool character. It's a neat concept. I think someone could do something fun with it. So if you're listening, Hollywood, make it happen. There
I'll see what I can do to get this out to Hollywood and
you go.
make that happen. Yeah, honestly, like I didn't have a really good answer to like either of those questions that I asked. I don't know. Like I had the question on my mind for such a long time for you, but I didn't have any thoughts for me. But I guess the one like t that pops up to me as a remake and I wouldn't say it's a favorite. I think I liked it quite a bit in its original state and then also in its like remastered state. I think the way that it happens in video games can be, interesting because, I think there was a while where you would see like a console go from like generation 3 to 4 or whatever was going on, and then they'd take the 3 game and like remaster it to 4, and it's basically just kind of like a fresh coat of paint. And I don't know necessarily how easy or hard that would necessarily be. I'm not a board game designer or programmer, so I'm guessing there's still a little bit more in it. But on the whole, I think a lot of people found that just kind of like one generation to the next remaster as a little uninspired, perhaps.
Yeah, it's funny. I really don't play as much as many computer games as I used to. So that's why my immediate thought was there's got to be some computer game that I used to play that I would like to see redone. But again, I don't play computer games so much anymore. So would I play? Like the only thing I play religiously is Diablo, which I have enjoyed the new Diablo quite a bit. And then I play Hearthstone all the time, but that's just the current thing. So anyway.
No, that's funny. Yeah, Hearthstone. I mentioned like kind of those digital CCG to card games.
Yeah.
That was one of them, but I binge them hard and then I ditch them because I can't keep binging them. That's kind of my cycle. Maybe I'll return to Hearthstone. But the game that I was thinking, it was initially a PlayStation 1 series, and then they did a like a big remaster of the whole one for the PlayStation 4, was Crash Bandicoot.
Oh yeah, I remember. I played that one way back in the day. Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, I like that
I'm
game.
so horrible at any of the dexterity style game. Like,
Oh.
I mean, I'm horrible at them, so.
I think one of the things that at least I thought I saw, I'm not like great at those dexterity platformer things, but I mean, I remember playing these games as a kid and being like decent, or going through levels
Right.
and progressing and getting far, and then playing them as an adult and having it be so tough.
Yeah.
Like, why was I so good at video games?
Yep.
But I did hear that there was some level of like the Crash's character that like the physics behind him, he slid a little bit more, so it made like the timing and the jumping a little tougher. I don't know if that's a substantiated claim or if I'm just saying that to make myself feel better, but
Either
that's
way.
either way. Okay, cool. We are to just the final wrap-up questions. The final question is just going to be, things to look out for from Restoration Games and you coming up. But before that, we'll just kind of finish up our text talk. And we've been talking about some remakes and some remaster ideas. But my penultimate question for you is, a text, any text that has been on your mind recently. So something that you've been reading, watching, playing, or listening to that you want to give a shout out.
Yeah, so I'm not really good at keeping up with television either.
Yeah.
But I've been I just finished watching so I'm The Wire. I'm halfway through season 5. So I'm almost done with it and it is fantastic. It is easily my favorite show of all time at this point. Before that I had just finished Breaking Bad, which at that time was my favorite show of all time. It was quite good. But I think The Wire overtook it. I just think it's fantastic. Really, the number of characters, the number of plots that they interweave, and then the dialogue is so great. The characters are so interesting. And my favorite thing is the way that they cross-cut from all the different plot threads from one to another to another to another in the course of an episode. And the scenes can be like 10 seconds or 30 seconds long. But somehow it all comes together. You're able to follow it all. It's just really kind of masterful. So I've really, really been enjoying that. Yeah.
Nice. I watched back in the day, mostly live. I think I caught up season one after the fact, but I did watch Breaking Bad, so I was up on TV then. And then I did, because of all the reasons you mentioned about The Wire and the way that the episodes and plot lines are constructed, I heard that was just like a masterwork of doing so. I don't know if I even finished season one, and it was just one of those many instances where I stopped watching something not because of the quality, but just because things happen and you stop
Life.
watching life. And then
Yeah. Yeah,
it's just 5 months later and you're like, oh, I was watching The Wire. Oh, okay.
I
So I'll
Yeah, I mean
definitely.
it's not going to be for everybody anyway. There's, it's obviously a pretty gritty show in general. Yeah, I've just really been enjoying it.
Yeah, I definitely was enjoying it when I was
It,
watching it.
and it's interesting. I'm in a way I'm glad I waited so long. Like if you were watching it at the time, I'm sure it was also great. But then I've waited so long now that it's sort of like a period piece. So it's not anachronistic. It's just like, oh, this was in the, 90s or whatever it was. So,
And
I think it in the end it helped me to wait so long to watch it.
well, I hope that that same experience holds true for me then too. That'll be good. Okay, but yeah, so in terms of like delivering projects, you mentioned crossbows and catapults, the Thunder Road Vendetta expansion finished up not super long ago on Kickstarter. But what else should people be looking out for from Restoration Games? Obviously, unmatched sets, stuff that you can talk about right now.
Sure. The big thing that we have Crossbows and Catapults is fulfilling. That's going to show up in stores in September as well. And then Thunder Road Vendetta, we have the Carnival of Chaos expansion. That'll be coming I think closer to October. Should be fulfilling fairly soon for backers. And then Unmatched wise, we are announcing next week a new Unmatched Adventures with a new license, a licensed set. So I imagine by the time this drops, that might have already come out. And we're super excited about that. That's our first Unmatched Adventures licensed edition. And then we have for regular Unmatched, we have a couple of Witcher sets coming out at the end of the year this year. We are working on sets into 2026 right now in the pipeline. Lots of stuff planned there. We have a very, very big project that we have not announced. We won't be announcing it till later this year. But that's for a whole new game line with a big license. Very exciting. Yeah, always we're working on. I just started working on first steps on a new Return to Dark Tower expansion. We've got Omega Virus that we've been working on for a while. That's proving a tough nut to crack in the vein of Return to Dark Tower because it has electronic components and things like that. But I think we're finally getting there. So it is definitely a project we're actively working on that we hope to get out pretty soon. Those are the big ones.
That sounds like a lot of big ones
Yeah.
coming up for sure. And sorry, I'm gonna hit you with one just kind of clarification question too. But I with all the unmatched sets, and kind of like being able to like announce them and release them, is there and just the licensing and stuff behind that, and some of them being licensed sets or linked to IPs and all that, does that like change the release schedule or throw wrinkles into like what you can do and when at all, or is it just kind of like whatever at this point?
Yeah, no, it's very much a different thing. The earlier license sets were handled by Mondo, and we were sort of co-publishing with them. But then once we took everything in-house, Witcher's our first license set, and it's been a bit of a learning experience. But yeah, everything, all the marketing stuff has to be approved and all that stuff. So it definitely adds to the process in terms of work and time. So we need to plan for that. We've hit a couple of bumps on some of these, so stuff's coming out a little later than we anticipated. But we're getting better at it, just like with anything else. Once we do it, we learn and don't make that mistake a second time. So we're getting better at it. But yeah, it definitely impacts it for sure.
Well, I really appreciate all that extra work and learning and growing for all those different sets for my own selfish reasons, and I'm sure that many other people are as well. And I also really just appreciate you taking your time to chat about all of like the different processes and design and development and work that you are doing with Restoration Games and just hanging out. I had a really nice time.
I did too. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Intertextual Cardboard Experience, the most restorative podcast about board games and any other text that they connect to. Thank you so much for choosing to spend your time here. Any further support, such as sharing the show with friends, following the page's socials in the episode description, writing a review, filling out the feedback form, or doing anything else you can think of is greatly appreciated. Keep playing, watching, reading, listening, experiencing.